Today, I'm talking with Scott Kermode, who's a professor of leadership at Fuller Seminary, who's been working on innovation in congregations. So, Scott, could we begin by you telling us a story about a congregation that you think is innovative?
One of the things that I've learned over this process is not to think about a congregation as being innovative, so much as thinking about innovation within congregations. It's too much pressure to put on a congregation and say, you need to be innovative. Jim Collins, when he was writing Good to Great, would talk about how you would look for organizations that had within them what he called pockets of greatness. He said it's too much to expect a whole organization to be able to turn so quickly. But what you can do is you as a leader can ask yourself, where do I have jurisdiction? Where do I have some kind of authority? And how can I then create a pocket of greatness? Well, I would say the same thing. Where can you create a pocket of innovation within whatever congregation you happen to be a part of? Are you responsible for youth ministry? Are you responsible for the deacons? Are you responsible for mission ministry? How can you create a pocket of innovation within a congregation? And the other thing I would say is don't start with the worship service, whatever you do. The worship service needs to be too many things. Let me give an example. When I was teaching my daughter to drive, I took her to the parking lot of our church on a day when Sunday afternoon, no one's there, and we just drove around. And I set up some dirt clods out in the middle and just let her weave in and out. And she practiced, and it was really, really low key. Now, let's say I wanted to be really supportive of her. And let's say that I had built a grandstand next to the church parking lot. And I'd invited all of her friends, and they came with banners and those big pictures with, you know, what they do at college basketball games, where they had pictures of her head, and they were all cheering for her. That would be very supportive. Would that be helpful? Absolutely not. Because what it would do is it would be ratcheting up the pressure. It would be like signing up to make your rookie mistakes in public. The last thing you want to do is make your rookie mistakes in public. And there is no more public place, there is no more contested space in a congregation than the worship service. So I invite people to start first outside the worship service, get innovation rolling, and then have it seep to the worship service.
Do you have a story about a congregation that you know that had a really innovative pocket? I love that image.
So let me tell you what I mean by innovation, and then I'll tell you a story about a congregation that embodied that. First of all, I know when scholars talk about innovation, they talk about basically five kinds of innovation. The first kind of innovation is product innovation, your iPhone, that kind of thing. We're not making an iPhone. The second type is like process innovation, things like creating an assembly line, the first guy to do that. You know, that's really interesting. That's not what we're doing. There's internet innovation, like creating an app. We're not doing that. There's innovation that is about social change, social service innovation. There have been churches that have tried that, but that's really not the core ministry of the church. The fifth kind of innovation is called what's called meaning-making innovation. And we live for meaning-making in the church. That's the best kind of innovation. Now, sometimes that involves structural innovation, creating new structures. So let me give you an example. I argue that the whole point of doing innovation is to focus on listening to the longings and losses of the people entrusted to your care. Innovation is not about the church. Innovation is about the people who have been entrusted to our care. There was a middle school pastor who was really interested in creating a pocket of greatness or a pocket of innovation. And so she started teaching lament to middle schoolers. And she took the five parts of what we would think of as form criticism, and she summarized each of them in a sentence. So, for example, the complaint part would be, God, I'm angry that, and then there's a blank. And she basically taught it to the middle schoolers like Mad Libs. She started by having them go through songs in contemporary culture that showed their angst, their anger. Then she gave them the Mad Libs. And for a couple of weeks, that's all they did is they just filled those in, and that was how they talked about it. But eventually they said, you know, we'd like to have our parents get involved in this. So they brought their parents in, and they taught them the lament. And that became a part of the conversation at home. And then after a while of doing this each week, the young people were saying, well, can we write our own laments? Is that okay? Yeah, sure. But because they already had the five parts to it, they could then write their own laments. Well, eventually the congregation heard about this and they said, wait a second, we want to get involved. And so this year during Lent, the focus for the congregation is lament. And it is being taught to the congregation by middle schoolers. And it's being taught in a way that focuses on these five parts. And it's a way that where a pocket of innovation could start within just the area you have jurisdiction, middle schoolers, expand out to their parents, and then expand out from there into the adults in the congregation and eventually to the worship service.
What initially drew you to innovation? How did you get interested in this whole area and the term and the work?
I started spending a lot of time about 7 years ago thinking about why my job is hard. My job is hard. I teach leadership. And the problem is I'm preparing students for a future that they can't imagine. I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I came up with a phrase that summarized the problem that every student experiences. And it's this: the church as we know it is calibrated for a world that no longer exists. The church as we know it is calibrated for a world that no longer exists. And so on the one hand, the church that my students are receiving is no longer ready to serve the people that will be entrusted to its care. But I cannot ask my students simply to go and change the church. For the first 10 years of my career, that's what we focused on, is how to do church change. And church change is a good thing, but there's a certain sense in which church change is often about figuring out how to map onto a future that we've already figured out. And I realized that many of my students are going to be the people that invent the future. So I had to figure out how to help them invent the future. And so that's when I went to this literature on innovation and found that there turns out to be a whole bunch of people in the scholarly world who've been thinking a lot about this. And from that, we created a process. I wrote a book, all that kind of stuff. It started from this realization that the church as we know it is calibrated for a world that no longer exists.
What are the barriers that you think stand in the way of congregations creating pockets of innovation?
I have two things that I try and teach congregations again and again. Well, for example, an hour ago, I had a coaching call with a congregation, and I was looking for two things especially. One is the discipline of listening. It turns out that listening with empathy changes us. It's not just listening so that I now understand, but empathy is different than sympathy. And so oftentimes congregations set out to do listening. And what we talk about is listening with. They set out to do listening with, and they end up doing listening to. That's the first mistake. The second one is Ronald Heifetz, when he talks about adaptive change, uses the phrase maintaining disciplined attention. It turns out that this takes what we often call a long obedience in the same direction. It requires a change in habit that happens over time. You can't just have a meeting, decide on something, and then ever be the same. It takes something where each week, each month, you are doing something that will change over time, creating new habits. That turns out to be difficult, especially when we have met with congregations 6 months later after they've been engaged in innovation. The number one thing that they've told us is that we just stopped meeting. We just stopped getting involved in doing all this stuff because we had the crush of everything else going on, the urgency of the moment. Well, one of the books that I really like about innovation is called Creativity Inc. It's by the guys that founded Pixar. And they talk about how one of the things that they have to fight is what they call the hungry beast of daily duties. And the hungry beast of daily duties eats innovation. We spend a lot of time when we work with congregations talking about how the hungry beast is coming and how to defend from it. And then many of our coaching calls are designed to get people back on track after they've been gnawed at by the hungry beast. So the two barriers are often the inability to listen with rather than listen for, and the inability to maintain disciplined attention.
Tell us a little bit about how you're working with congregations around innovation.
We at Fuller, we have three different projects that are going on that are all parallel to each other. One on youth ministry innovation, one on young adult ministry innovation, one on innovation for vocation. And based out of that first question where I asked about the church calibrated for a world that no longer exists, I went back and designed a method. And it is a method then that we are using with each of the three groups. I'll tell you about the theology behind the method in a moment, but first I'll just tell you how the method plays out in practice. What we do is we invite congregations in cohorts of congregations. So we'll have 5, 6, 10 congregations at a time. We have had as large a group for one of the youth ministry innovation groups as 35 congregations working at once. And what we'll do is they'll have groups of 2 or 3 people that will be leading that. And we'll have 3 stages to the project. First is before we gather them, what we do is we have each group go through what we call a pre-summit workshop, where it's an online workshop. They spend 5 weeks learning about innovation, learning about listening, about learning about practices. About half the exercises are designed to get them listening with, and about half the exercises are there to get them used to reinventing practices. And then we have the second stage is we have a summit where we gather all those churches together and we spend 2.5 days doing innovation. We spend the first Wednesday night and all day Thursday taking them through an innovation cycle. I'll tell you what the cycle is in a minute. And then at the end of that, they have a prototype that they can take back. And then on Friday, once they've gotten used to it, we do it all over again. So by the end of the gathering, they have 2 pop ideas to take home with them. And then the third stage is an experiment stage where we give them a few months of practice, and then they have 10 weeks to actually put it in practice. And we do coaching calls in between to work on that. Theologically, what we're trying to do is bring together 3 literatures, bring together the idea of the Christian practice of discernment, bring together practical theology methods. So that there's a bunch of practical theologians and they've put together method. And if you look at any number of them, there's kind of a least common denominator of what they're talking through. And then human-centered design is probably the best way in which innovators have decided to do innovation in the secular world. I wrote an article in about 2004 for the Journal of Religious Leadership where I talked about how practical theology applies to leadership. And then I realized that the 4 nodes of the practical theology method actually map very nicely onto what the secular world talks about as human-centered design. And so if you put those together, you get 4 stages. And those 4 stages are empathetic listening, divergent reflection, where you generate as many ideas as possible, convergent deciding, where you then narrow it down to decide on one thing, and then experimental prototyping, where you decide how are we going to put that into action. And then you likely go through the cycle one more time, and then you're ready to enact. But one of the things in Silicon Valley and in other places where innovation is common, they say never come to a meeting without a prototype. What they mean by that is every time somebody poses a problem, don't just think through how you would solve it, but at least think about how to operationalize it. And it doesn't have to be something really difficult. I mean, you could just mock it up on a sheet of paper, but always think through the process, because my experience of churches and my experience of seminaries is we are often satisfied where if we've talked about a problem, we think we have solved the problem. An antidote to that is the prototyping.
Said as a true practical theologian.
Absolutely.
Okay, now you're going to tell us about the theology?
Well, the theology is then how I brought it all together. If you look, for example, at Rick Osmer's practical theological method, and you map it onto, I would argue that that is very similar to a cycle. He doesn't always call it a cycle. In conversation, he'll call it a cycle, but in the book, he doesn't necessarily. But it's kind of a cycle. And it's not unlike the method that human-centered design has put together. And so if you kind of map them onto each other, you see that they are trying to accomplish very similar kinds of things. And that's how I do it.
Have you changed your mind about the way you think about innovation by doing this work with congregations in these different projects?
Yeah. The biggest thing that I've changed my thinking on is I went in thinking that the purpose of innovation was to create a program. When I've come to believe it's about making meaning. And oftentimes programs get in the way of meaning making. And that because we try and do too much too quickly, we end up settling for solving a little tiny bit of the problem because that's all we can get at quickly. And we don't do the meaning making. So I think, for example, of the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement, as we think of it, probably begins in the first week of December 1955. It's when Rosa Parks wouldn't ride the bus. It's when over the weekend when women distributed flyers saying that we're going to have a bus boycott. Monday, they have a bus boycott. And then Monday evening, December 5th, they're gathered together in a church to have a response. How are we going to respond to this bus boycott? And they turn to Martin Luther King, who's a local pastor, and say, you've got 15 minutes to prepare a response. And he gives his what we can think of as often the first public speech of the civil rights movement. And he did that by saying, what he said was, the world is going to tell you have to choose between being a good American and a good Christian. Good Americans obey the law. Good Christians stand up for justice. But right now, there is no way for you to do both. Because if you stand up for justice, it will lead to violence and you will break the law. I want to introduce you to nonviolent protest and tell you that there is a way to be both a good Christian and a good American. And in the space of about 15 minutes, a short speech, he is able to change the very mental model that they have about what it means to be a good Christian and a good American. So that kind of meaning making then created a pathway, an avenue for action is what I call it. And so the kind changing people's mental models is more important than giving them programs. The second thing is that it's about the people entrusted to your care, and it's not about the church itself. Oftentimes, when we think about innovation, when we talk with congregations, they talk about we need to innovate in order to save ourselves. That is not a good reason to do innovation. We need to do innovation because we have a people entrusted to our care. And those people deserve to hear a gospel that is attached to the life that they lead. The gospel that we are speaking now is designed for a world that no longer exists. They're going to need something different. And as long as we keep focusing on the people entrusted to our care, we do a good job with innovation. And the moment we start focusing on the needs of the church, it becomes stale.
You're one of the hubs in our initiative called Lives of Meaning and Purpose, and helping people in congregations think about God's calling in their life. What do you think is the relationship between innovation and vocation?
Sure. So I've told you what I mean by innovation. Let me tell you what I mean when I talk about vocation. For me, vocation, the best place to start biblically for me is 2 Corinthians 5. 2 Corinthians 5 talks about how God was in the world, reconciling the world to himself in Christ Jesus. And eventually it talks about us getting ministries of reconciliation, and that's where we tend to go. But the most important part of that is that God was in the world, reconciling the world to himself in Christ Jesus. And towards the end of that passage, it says, and we are therefore Christ's ambassadors. And I love this idea of ambassador. An ambassador is the citizen of one country who goes to live in another country with the express purpose of making good relations between the two. 500 years ago, when Martin Luther was writing about calling and vocation, he talked about how we are citizens of heaven who live among the kingdom of this earth, and we are supposed to practice the love of neighbor wherever, and he used the word, wherever our station is. Now, that's a static term that I'm not going to probably play with, but I love this idea of enacting love of neighbor wherever you are planted. That's what it means to be an ambassador. And so for me, my whole understanding of vocation is to enact the love of neighbor wherever you are planted. So whether if you are the manager of a drugstore, that's one of the cases that we often work with our people. It talks about how that person could be an ambassador. To me, the key to it all is the people entrusted to your care. Vocation is about the people entrusted to your care. Innovation is about the people entrusted to your care. So there is a great way in which the two of them meet.